Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Last Sunday, right at the end of the show, we got the news about the death of Jerry Lewis. He died 91 years old at his home in Las Vegas. Turned out to be several problems. He'd been hospitalized for a while, but the cause of death turned out to be that his heart was not pumping enough blood at 91 years old. Obviously a legend with all of the movies that he left us through his career, and television appearances and nightclub appearances and all that he did. There's no denying Jerry Lewis, a true legend in show business. I had the pleasure of talking to him a few times, several times here on the radio, on the phone, and a couple of times in person when he was here in Chicago promoting different things. And one of those times was in 2005 when he just had a book out called Dean and Me that was about his relationship with his longtime partner of 10 years, Dean Martin. And he spoke very candidly and honestly about his relationship with Dean. He talked about lots of different things with us through the course of the interview. So we thought today we would go back into the vault and share that 2005 interview with the legendary Jerry Lewis.
Jerry, why did you write this? Why did you decide to put all this down?
I never planned on it. But the day of December 25th, 1995, when I was told that my partner died, I sat down at the typewriter and I just had to get some stuff out. The very, very beginning material, if you read it now, is grieving. And then I went from there. I wrote it and it's a 10-year period with which I took from the beginning to the wrap-up. But I had a lot of things that I had to say about my partner primarily that needed to be said. I carried a tremendous amount of guilt that he was an underrated performer. And I couldn't handle that. And I've been handling it for a long time. You know, we split up 49 years ago. We teamed up 59 years ago. Woo! And for most of the 49 years after the split, I had a kind of not a fire in the belly, but a gnawing in the belly. I had to get it out the best way I knew how. And because of time constraint and people that buy books like them to be a certain size, if they printed my original manuscript, this book would have been 1,700 pages. It's impossible. You know, Jewish War and Peace, we don't need.
What was that gnawing? How would you describe what that gnawing was, whatever it was that you felt like you had to say?
Well, it's what I knew. Bosley Crowther wrote a review about our first film. He used up most of a full New York Times column, laudatory for Jerry. Jerry this, Jerry that, he's the movie, you should see that, and when he did. And then he also, and Dean Martin has a pleasant voice. But when Jerry did, and that was the way it went for 10 years, there was a concert we did in San Francisco. They wrote about it in the San Francisco Chronicle the next morning. They didn't mention my partner's name, okay? I have something that I can show you that's quite interesting, but it tells you the whole story. I have a poster that someone sent me from Germany who was a real Martin and Lewis groupie. The film opens in Berlin. It was Hollywood a bust. And this poster was on a 6-story building. Largest one they've ever done. You see my partner's picture there?
Oh, wow.
Do you see my partner's name there?
Wow. It's Jerry and a dog and no Dean.
Right. And he took that for 10 years. Never a word. Never on what about, nothing. And when I finally confronted him, like in our eighth year, I said, how do you do this? If you weren't there, I'd still be a record act. Don't you understand the depth of your commitment to what we do? He said, the act is making more money than anyone that ever made this kind of thing in show business. I said, I don't want to just disrupt anything. I said, disrupt? Holy God. In the ninth year, I was still trying to get through to him about the why and wherefore and telling him about other comedy teams and so on. But even that, I flinched at because this was not another comedy team. This was a tremendous amount of love and pride. I was awestruck every time I stood on the stage with him. And he was like a proud papa at everything that I did. So the love that those men had underneath it all, that jerks like Bosley Crowther wouldn't see if he was handed, it was handed to him and laid on the retina of his eye. He wouldn't see it. And that troubled me throughout. And I never quite understood why people didn't look a little more deeply and to see who the marionette was. And who was the puppet?
The way that you describe it in the book, though, it sounded like in time he did feel
like the
second banana. And ultimately, that sounded like mm-hmm. what led to the breakup. Is he was tired of being playing second banana to the nine-year-old, as you said.
No, he never tired of that. He loved every minute we ever did together. He was tired of what that brought him in terms of gratification, what the applause that he hears is for both of us. But when that applause dies down, Jerry is still flying high on Bravos, and it's him and he, which I always felt was just plain unfair. Mm-hmm. And I felt that if I wrote this book, I could just make some, it's not going to do anybody any good, really. But when I gave the book to Jeannie, Dean's wife, she called me the night before last and she said, I want you to know how much I love you. I said, I love you too, Jeannie. She said, but I love you because you gave Dean such a Valentine. It made it all worthwhile.
Did you intend for it to be a book when you sat down the day that Dean died? Or
no,
was
I'm
it something just
notes.
Cathartic for you
yeah,
dealing
was,
with the death of your...
I wasn't planning a book. I was just writing notes, which I do all the time.
How do you think Dean would have reacted?
He'd have been very proud.
Yeah.
He would have been proud of what I had done, and not necessarily the subject matter. That's not the way he was. He always cheered for whatever I did. He was always so supportive and so strong and so giving. He would have loved it. I know that.
What would you say was the highest point, the greatest point when you and Dean were working together?
Every night that we went on stage. There was no high point. They were all incredulous, as they say. The fact that we walked out from both sides of the stage and met center, that was utopia for me. And he had the best time of his life. And they were paying us tons of money to go out there and act like complete idiots. And we had much more fun than anyone in the audience. When we played the Chicago Garden in 1953, we played to 20,000 people. And I'd look up there and see those seats. What do they see? But they're responding.
Yeah.
They had the best time, and we did one of the best shows of our lives because you overproject. In a setup like that, you have to do what you do and make it stronger so that it has legs, you know.
Place to the last row.
It was just and the only reason I brought it up is because I'm in Chicago.
Yeah.
Every time I come to Chicago, I think about the shapery and the excellence with which all of that went down. We came in for 2 weeks and we stayed 24, I think.
I was going to say, in the book you described Chicago being really like kind of a pivotal place where things really began to take off.
Oh, yeah.
For you and Dean.
I mean, really did.
It was here, really, that
you guys began to get a sense of yourself as a comedy duo, right. And audiences began to crave you. I mean, it was like rock star status.
It was like Sinatra and the Beatles combined.
Yeah.
I mean, I would walk up to the Chez Prix, get out of the car, walk up to the entrance, and it would take me 15 minutes to get into the... I would yell at them, there'll be no show unless you open up here, so you let the juice slide in. It was pandemonium.
Yeah.
And the biggest money maker in all of Chicago was the maitre d' at the Chez Prix.
Right.
No telling what he made a night. Incredible. And remember, we did 3 shows a night at the Chez Prix. And we packed it. We did the same thing at the Chicago Theater. Chicagoans have always been absolute supporters of Dean and myself. As a matter of fact, we did one of the first Colgate shows out of the Studebaker Theater that was on Michigan. I don't know if it's still there. Michigan Boulevard. That theater was where we took the second Colgate Comedy Hour. We did the first in New York. Then we were booked to play the Shea, so we brought the show here at the Studebaker Theater. It was incredible.
When you watch those old Colgate Comedy Hours, and you and Dean, it's magic to watch that. I mean, it's a study in friendship and chemistry and timing, and every comedian should study those tapes to watch. Mm-hmm. But the thing that strikes me most about those is the uproarious response. The funniest comedian today, whoever you pick, whoever you think is funniest and whoever you've laughed hardest at, you see the people reacting to you and Dean 10 times funnier.
Oh, yeah.
They're completely out of control watching you guys.
Right.
What was that?
A different culture. You had a different man, woman, and child in homes around this country in 1950. The war had just concluded. The grief was put behind them. They needed a voice, they needed to identify, and they found, what's better than watching two people that love one another, having such a good time, and getting paid astronomical money for it? An audience doesn't say, I wish that was me, they say, I'm glad I'm in on it.
Yeah.
And that's what it was.
There's a bit that we were watching this morning, Dean is singing in the rain.
Yeah.
You spit a little water on him, and
he
giggles a little bit. He laughs a little bit, and continues to sing. You go get, I think, a glass of water next, and throw it at him.
Then it was a bucket.
Then a pitcher, a bucket.
Yeah.
He's just not missing a beat.
Right.
You're not missing a beat. Do you remember that day? I mean,
Absolutely.
What was that like for you?
Well,
what's going through your mind while that's happening?
I had written it and brought it to Dean and told him about it. He said, what about the tuxes? I said, well, where are the ones? We both have 8 of them. Don't worry about it. Oh, okay. And we never showed it to cameras or the crew. I did that a lot of times. And when we did it, it was the first time anybody in the studio saw it, except for a phone call I made to our camera director, and I told him where to be loose and where to be closer.
Yeah.
But we never thought it would go to where it went because the stage was very slick. We didn't realize how slick. And we went and followed the beats that we had created, and it was hysterical. I mean, the people in the theater were only 700 or 800, but the mail we got about that was just incredible. They're watching $3,000 or $4,000 tuxes at the time get turned into accordion pleats, and I'm swimming on this wet floor.
Yeah.
Those things happen, and we did it live, and people saw it, and it meant something.
There's something that's really beautiful about those shows and your live shows. I wish I had been around to see those, because you brought the audience sort of inside the show also.
Sure.
It was...
I still do it.
Yeah.
Come to Vegas. I'm going to play 6 times this year, because my lung is better, and I'll play in concert at the Orleans 6 times this coming year. Then I'm doing 21 concerts in Paris and 4 weeks at the London Palladium. Get off your butt and come and see. You'll see the way it works.
It's our 2005 conversation with Jerry Lewis After a quick break, the second half of the interview, in which he talks about acknowledging being a bully to Dean Martin. That's coming up next. Are you digging the Jerry Lewis interview? I'm totally digging this Jerry Lewis interview from 2005. When he was here talking about his book, Dean and Me, book that he wrote.
About you and him?
about us.
Oh, that other Dean.
That other Dean, apparently. Yeah, one of us, I'm not sure. But he's pretty candid about the whole thing, and fun to sit down with him. This was back in 2005, and he admitted in this interview that there were times during their relationship when he was not the easiest person in the world to get along with.
You said in the book that you were a bully to Dean. Were you?
A bully?
A bully.
When it came to work, when I insisted that we need to do that again, and I didn't bully him, but he knew that if it was theatrical, I was right. And he knew if it had to do with the act, I was right. He never, ever, ever pulled back when it came to the best interest of our work. When I called for a rehearsal on a day he was going to go play golf, I fixed that. We'll work on it when you get home. We'll work on it between shows. But I never got in the way of that because it meant so much to him. He loved that so much, probably more than anything, simply because nobody would talk to him out there. He didn't have to talk to anyone else. And he spoke and, I guess, talked to people that he chose to, but there was a wonderful reclusiveness about the game. Get out there with the sun and the air and the grass. And he was a very good player. So put that all together, and that was what he wanted to do more than anything. So I had to protect that.
One of the things that I found interesting in the book is talking about the people that you worked with and the stars that craved coming to your shows. They would fill the audience
absolutely
wherever you performed, and that included Sinatra and whoever the biggest names were of the day, but also the great leading ladies of the day.
Yeah,
that you worked with professionally, and in the book you also kind of hint that there was a little working non-professionally with the ladies of the day.
I beg your pardon.
The ladies of the day.
Are you?
I just read the book. I'm just telling you what I read.
Are you saying to me that you think that I am a poofter? No, that's the wrong word. You think I'm a fop.
I'm thinking that you were some of the biggest leading ladies of the day is what I'm
saying. I had some wonderful times. And the thing that always struck my funny bone was Dean was this handsome sex pot. And he was usually in the suite watching Westerns while I was taking care of female business. And then someone once wrote, Jerry Lewis had an affair with every one of his leading ladies. One of my leading ladies was Agnes Moorhead.
Well,
I don't think so.
You lucky devil,
yeah. Right. We had a great time, let's put it that way.
Did you have affairs with your leading ladies?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah? Name of names?
No.
No?
But if you go to Blockbuster and you buy some Martin Lewis films,
you can figure out, except for Agnes Moorhead, you can pretty much figure
except
it out.
Except for Agnes.
Apparently.
We had good times, my friend.
Yeah. What was the time that you regret most with your time with Dean?
I guess the strongest regret was how tumultuous the ending was. The last 7-8 months where we weren't talking was that I regret. That was also a terrible case of stupidity on both our parts. But I don't believe the guy that says I divorced my wife but we're still friends. Really? He's either a liar, a fool, or a moron. There is no such animal. Unless he didn't love her in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because you can't be in love with someone, break up, and have it mean nothing. You will live with a world of angst and pain and disillusionment, and human beings act oddly during angst. They really aren't clear how to deal with it, and they rarely will deal with it with self-deprecation. They will deal with it with anger, and vengeance and revenge, and you say things you don't mean. You do things you don't mean. And we had a close bond that couldn't be severed by any manner of means. And I regret that it got to that.
I don't know how you performed during that time. As you read that,
it was tough.
I can't even imagine how you go on stage and do, especially what you guys did, that where your chemistry and mm-hmm. your personal relationship was so pivotal. When you read the book, you learn really what was going on and mm-hmm. how you felt about each other.
We were able to do it because we never, ever once diminished the foundation.
Yeah.
With all of the angst, we never once impaired what we had. All we did was become a couple of people that we really weren't for the wrong reasons. And you couldn't in any way depart from the excellence of their work.
Yeah.
And they were both absolute professionals on that stage. And they both felt a keen responsibility to their audience that stayed in the snow for an hour and a half to get in. You can't walk out there and dog a show. We never, ever did that in the worst moments.
Is it true that you still haven't seen
Hollywood
or Bust, your last film together? What? Why can't you watch it?
I never watch it.
Why?
I just have too painful, too many bad memories.
Speaking of films that we haven't seen, The Day the Clown Died. What? Why?
The Day the Clown Cried?
The Day the Clown Cried, I'm sorry.
You never will.
Why?
As long as I own it, you never will.
Why?
Well, because I worked very hard in the writing, I worked very hard in the directing, and I worked three times as hard in portraying this sad German Jew clown. And the role was very, very tough. And I worked so hard at that portrayal that the work I did as a director was inferior. When I looked and saw what I did, I had a great dramatic performance by the actor, and I had a less than perfect performance by the director, and I shelved it. I just wouldn't do that to an audience or myself.
You look fantastic.
I am terrific.
I have to tell you, you've lost how much?
78 pounds I've lost. I still got about 10 to go.
Everybody was so concerned about you 2-3 years
yep,
ago or something when they saw you on the telephone.
Everybody was wonderful.
And this pain device that you have now, mm-hmm. really, it's literally revolutionized your life and reinvigorated
you. Well, from the standpoint of pain, yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, prednisone, which Dr. DeBakey called the greatest, worst drug ever conceived, puts a lot of weight on you. And the moment the prednisone was gone, I was able to get on a regimen of exercise and diet, and I'm still on it.
And this device that you have short-circuits the chronic pain that you would have
the
otherwise.
The chronic pain is handled by the stimulator. Medtronic makes the pacemaker, which has kept 3 or 4 million people on the planet. They also invented the stimulator, which is a metal bar put on the spinal column. I have two electrodes that come from here, the battery under my skin,
mm-hmm.
which comes around, and I have this remote. But when I hit the battery with the remote,
yeah.
it stops the pain from going to the brain.
Yeah, short circuits it.
So I'm without pain, having had it for 37 years every day and every minute and every hour.
Yeah.
Chronic pain can be handled. There are people out there suffering with chronic pain that really don't have to. Here, I'll click it. Good night.
I knew I should have waited till the end of the interview.
See, I raise the stimulation here.
Yeah.
Turn it on there. Turn it off here.
Yeah.
Lower it left. Lower it right. And it also opens my garage door.
Well, what does it feel like when you do that? Is it a? Do you feel a shock or anything?
I know I have an erection for 9 months, which is wonderful, and I've had the best time with it.
You know what? I got one, too,
yeah,
while you
right.
did that. So.
It's little tingling, that's
yeah.
all. You feel very little tingling.
Yeah.
More importantly, you feel no pain.
Yeah.
Now, you have to be a candidate for this. But if you are, and you've had pain for 20 years, you can be without it with the Medtronic stimulator.
Yeah.
It is an incredible miracle.
What's the legislation that you're working? You told me
the legislation is that we have to do something about people in chronic pain when they're told that their insurance carrier won't cover this procedure. Some do, some don't. But chronic pain has been kicked under the rug. And I do a seminar, let's say there's 900 people, and I'll say, how many present have chronic pain? 90% of the audience's hands go up. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's got to be somewhere where the 75 million people are. So we're working on a variety of legislations that have to be done. Ultimately, it has to be addressed and met. But right now, you see, I can't get into politics because I do comedy already. So once we clean up our government a little bit, get them to sit up and do right, we'll get some of this stuff done ultimately.
Are there things that you still want to do professionally?
I've always wanted to be a Viking.
Really? You'd look nice in the metal brassiere and the big hat.
I'm sure. I knew you would understand.
Yeah, yeah.
What I want to do is do what I did this morning. I opened my eyes and I was a hit. What better than that? I got a load on the calendar. I got a lot of stuff to do. I got 4 films to complete. I've got concerts in Rome, London. I got to play Vegas. I have to do a screenplay that I must finish in the next 3 months. I'm fairly busy.
Will there be more remakes of some of your old films?
Yes, I've sold some of my films to be remade to Metro, Paramount, 20th Century, Pandemonium, Disney.
And what about this book, Dean and Me? Will this become a motion picture?
Well, I don't know. I know that somebody has already inquired about doing it as a musical on Broadway, but I have to think about that. More importantly, next year, I'm directing a musical on Broadway called The Nutty Professor.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
And I'm in the throes of putting that together now. So if you get out of here, I can go to work.
There you go. Our conversation with Jerry Lewis in 2005, of the many conversations that we've had with Jerry Lewis, they've all been, very, very pleasant and very cordial. Although an interview was released earlier this year in which he was being interviewed by, it sounded like a kind of a young journalist, fairly, and honestly, somewhat not very prepared journalist. Interviewing him, and Jerry just gave him one-word answers, and it was painful to listen to. Very, very difficult to listen to. It's on YouTube and, the web. It's easily found. Think about the many times that he's been interviewed, over the last 60 years. Just some days, I guess he just didn't feel like being interviewed. But as you could hear from this interview and other interviews that we've had, he was pleasant, very, very pleasant when we've had our conversations. There were challenging moments. A lot of people will tell you that there were challenging moments with Jerry Lewis through the years. But, all of that doesn't matter. He passed away last Sunday, 91 years old. And most of all, we will remember the legacy of laughs that he has left us through the years. So hope you enjoyed that trip back into the vault this morning.